We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
I think in any interview that we're going to do, I'm going to tell you it's a long season because it is, not just for us, but for everyone. The season isn't completed or accomplished or whatever in any 1 week period. It's a series of weeks. And then do you get better? Do you stay healthy? How do you make the next week better? It's all about that.
Beverly off of a screen. Fed it back to Wardenburg. Driving inside. Blocked by White. Likes. Drives by Jones. Gets airborne onto Laurier. Got it swatted away. And Jones out of there with the basketball. Down the court to the right corner. Baker a three. Bang! Lob it to Stanley. Puts that thing down with the right hand.
We got back to playing good defense. And not turning it over. The few turnovers we had, they turned into points. And that's what our guys have to understand. Those live ball turnovers, that's what we gave up against Louisville. We defended the three well. You know, those three kids, Likes, Vasiljevic, and McGussie, you know, they can really play. You're trying to get over the human nature of it's going to be easy to get over those two losses because you won by so much the first game. All the stuff that we did, I was really pleased that our kids listened. They not only heard, but they listened and then believed what we were talking about, and then they turned it into a really good performance.
It was indeed an impressive performance for the Blue Devils on Tuesday night as they got back on the winning track, beating Miami. As we welcome you into the Duke Basketball Podcast, David Schumann alongside Associate Head Coach John Shire. And Coach, it kind of speaks to the topsy-turvy nature of the ACC this year. That was Duke's fourth 30-plus point win in conference play, tying the school record. Wild, only 8 games into league play. The games have kind of been all over the place a little bit.
It has. It's been a heck of a start. You know, 6-2, some really good wins, like you said. Also some definite moments where we have a lot to learn, Louisville being one of them. But it's part of the nature of this league and this year in college basketball.
Got a great show lined up for you. We're going to hear from Tommy Amaker a little bit. We're going to throw back to the start of the Coach K era. Also talk about the team. And this guy made his debut in the NBA this week. I don't know if you've heard of him. Zion Williamson.
It's a pretty good debut. Not bad. Four for four from three. It's decent.
He's all right. Did you teach him?
No, I can't take any credit for that. That was all him. That was all him.
We're going to talk about that a little bit before we get out of here. But let's start with the team. 16-3 now. 6-2 in the league. This is not something that's terribly common, at least the last few years here on campus. A week between games, you guys opted not to slot in that non-conference game in the middle of league play. With this team in particular, from my perspective, I think it's a good thing. I'm curious from your perspective.
No, it's a really good thing. We have a lot to work on. I think one of the things when you get into league play and when you're consistently playing two games a week, you lose some of your habits. You get into a grind where you're working on preparation and game plan as opposed to yourselves. So this week we get a chance to look at ourselves, some things defensively, some things offensively. We want to do better. We get a chance to break it down, work on our habits, and, you know, be in a better spot a week from, you know, when we last played.
Of course, Pittsburgh will be the next opponent coming up on Tuesday night from Cameron Indoor Stadium. That game against Miami, I know a lot of people that maybe follow casually or checking in here and there are saying, okay, you beat a Miami team that's below 500 in league play. Duke did what they should have. It feels like, though, that win was maybe bigger than most just because of, one, stopping the momentum of the consecutive losses, but, two, setting up this week of work and going into it on a positive note, particularly on the defensive end.
Yeah, well, we didn't come off of a very good defensive performance versus Louisville. And you're playing a Miami team. You know, they're up by 9 with 4 minutes to go, you know, against Florida State. They played at Louisville a couple weeks back. You know, they had a chance to cut it to 2 with a few minutes to go. I mean, they've been a very dangerous team. But when we've been at our best, it's been our defense, like you said. And so we had a chance. We did that against Miami. We need to continue to do that. And now we get a chance to work on our habits, even, you know, little things every day, Shoemate, like blocking out and coming over to help and our ball screen defense. We need to work on these things, and now we get a chance to get back and do that.
Blue Devils put in 11 threes, 9 in the first half against Miami. The leading scorer for the team, though, continues to be Vernon Carey Jr. 17 points a game, 8 rebounds per game, 8 double-doubles, but obviously when you explode like he did on the scene at the outset of the season, he has clearly become, if not the focal point, certainly one of them in the opposition scouting report. Take us through that for a young player. When you see 2 or 3 defenders crashing at you at every opportunity and having to work through the mental side of things, when you're used to being the go-to guy to go and score, to make those reads and know, for the team to win, I might have to work on my assist game tonight.
Well, it's an adjustment, and sometimes it's not even his assist. Sometimes it's because there's 2 guys around him. We may just pass it to someone else and they get a shot because of the attention that Vernon draws. And so he's adjusting. He's also learning how, when he gets it, now you don't have the time that you normally have. And so you have a lot of hands. You know, he's gotten the ball knocked away from him a few times. And, you know, he's got 2 or 3 guys in there and there's a lot of contact. And so learning how to play through that quickly but also aggressively and still getting opportunities for him to score. The thing that he's done a really good job of that you mentioned is distributing as well.
For those that don't follow it super closely, Miami most of the year has been a man-to-man defensive team, and they come out and they play almost exclusively zone against you guys. Jim Larrañaga talked about in the postgame, said, my plan was to sit back and let him shoot threes. And I say that because, you know, the big guy, Vernon Carey Jr., he didn't hit a 3 on Tuesday night. How many of those were credited to him, though, because of the defense has to adjust to him? You get 1 post touch, and then you got wide open shooters.
No, a bunch. And that's what, you know, we've talked about as a staff and talked to our team about. Teams are playing us differently. And a huge key is going to be trying to keep us out of the paint because of Vernon and because of we have a lot of attackers and drivers. And so figuring out ways to not just settle for threes, but to get in the paint. And then that will lead to open threes, which we got against Miami and knocked him in. And Matt Hertz, you know, really shot a great percentage, and he's been really hot as of late.
Yeah, you look at what Hurt has done in conference play from the perimeter, 19 of 38, hitting 50% of his threes. Let's talk about that two-headed monster we've talked about at times on the defensive end of the floor, but I want to flip it and talk about the offensive side of things. Trey Jones paces the ACC in terms of assists a game right around 7. We talked so much about Jordan Goldwire's defense. Did you know, I guess this is the segment of the podcast, he leads the ACC in assist-to-turnover ratio?
He does. I did know that. I I was thinking about interrupting you and calling it out, but it's incredible. You know, those two guys, when you handle the ball as much as they do, and you're getting that production, like you said, on the defensive side of the ball where they're pressuring it and getting after the ball, but then on offense, they're so steady. It does a lot for your team. And so Jordan Goldwire, he's been making simple, great plays. And they've been great plays, but simple. And it's carried over to our production on the offensive end.
Before we get in our conversation with Tommy Amaker here in just a second, psychologically, and we touched on this earlier, for the guys to see what you guys put in the couple of days, Martin Luther King Jr. holiday was on Monday, so you had a chance to hit the practice floor a couple of times because of no class. But to see all that work pay off in a performance like that, you don't want to overdo it because it's just a two-game skid. And by the way, the numbers are bananas. I don't know if you knew this. In the last two decades, Duke has lost two or more games in a row just 15 times. It's happened less than one time per year. Speaks to the excellence of coach, but doesn't happen very often. So you're trying to get out of that, to have that monkey off the back, so to speak, as they begin their work this coming week.
So does that include my freshman year when we lost four in a row? Does that count as two, or does that count as one?
Yes, I said two or more. See, you went there. You always give me crap. I didn't go negative.
Sometimes I'm a little sensitive about my freshman year, you know, just with some of the things that throughout. But no, it's incredible. And in all seriousness, the Miami game, you know, you talk about being a big game, but, you know, I found always as a player here and as a coach, Duke teams respond the best after a loss. You know, like, how do you respond after you have a game you didn't play as well and that you lose? And that's what we pride ourselves on. So coming back, no question, losing two in a row, you don't want to have happen. But now how do you respond? And we responded in a great way.
And Coach talked about before the game, turnovers and free throws. Well, just 10 turnovers and 10 of 13 at the line, a big reason why Duke was able to get that 89-59 win. It is Coach's 40th season here at Duke, and we've been kind of looking back at some of the championship runs, but thought we'd flash it all the way back to the beginning and think about how this thing got started. We're going to hear from Tommy Amaker here in just a second. Your perspective on those guys as you've gotten to know them over the years, obviously Johnny Dawkins. If you guys haven't seen the documentary, you need to check it out, The Class That Saved Coach K. You know, to me, when I look at the decade of the 80s for Coach, you think about the last three decades and the excellence and the national championships and the winning. For me, when you look at the 80s, that's Coach the recruiter, right? Because you weren't recruiting to all these wins and all this previous success. You were recruiting to you, and you were convincing guys that you were the guy. And time and again, they said he was the single reason that they came here.
Yeah, and, you know, I think there's a belief you have to instill. And Coach did that. You know, Tommy's talked about it. I remember, you know, Johnny's talked about it as well. Like, they believed in him. And, I mean, it showed, you know, you look back, that 86 team, you know, really, there's no more important team in the history of Duke basketball. That's the team that started it all. You know, they're right there this close to winning a national championship. Arguably one of the best teams, if not the best team, never to win a national championship. But there's no question I'm not where I am today. Many of my teammates, the current guys we coach, we're all not here today if it's not for that 86 team and Tommy Amaker being one of them.
And what he brought to that team, from your perspective, the way he changed that team to be able to make the run that they could to free up Dawkins and those guys.
Yeah, Tommy was just the ultimate point guard. You know, he was a leader. You know, hearing Coach talk about him, I don't know if there's anybody who's fully lived up to the expectations since Tommy's come through. But, you know, you talk about, you know, one of the things with Coach, you know, he was a point guard himself. So that point guard-coach relationship, especially for him, is important. And I think people who know about that team, you got that firsthand with Tommy in Coach and the relationship even to this day.
When we hear that in the conversational special, did you experience that when you were the point for Coach?
I did experience that. I did. And
did your teammates let you know that you were getting special treat?
I don't know if it was like Tommy and Coach, but no, we had a great relationship. And by the end of it, I knew what he wanted and did my best to make it happen on the court.
Tommy Amaker, of course, is the head coach at Harvard. One of his assistants is Mike Sotsky. He's going to be a part of this conversation as well. He was a manager here at Duke not too long ago. Before we start the conversation, your thoughts on that? That's one of the parts of Coach's legacy. I think it's talked about as much. The managers do so much work around this program, and a number of them have gone on to successful careers in their own right.
Yeah, well, not only what they do in their time here, it's amazing the amount of managers we've had go on and be successful, of course, in business and in life, but then in the basketball world. And, you know, we've had one stay on our staff, Zach Marcus. You know, he's our video coordinator, and he's great. And, you know, Mike Sotsky, what he's done at Harvard. I could go on and on. You know, I'm not going to name, you know, all the names. There's a lot, but it's incredible what our managers have gone on to do.
And with that, let's jump into our conversation with Tommy Amaker and Mike Sotsky. You're one of the few guys that's got a shot to be a head coach for 40 years because you started so young. But if someone said to you, hey, you've been a head coach for 40 years, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Let me stop you right there. We'll never be at the 40-year mark. It's amazing that he's been able to do what he's done 40 years at Duke. I mean, I when I think of that, and it's just mind-boggling that he's been able to do it that long and to be that great at it that long and still in my opinion, and hopefully so, that there's no slowing down in sight. I mean, he looks like he's raring to go for the next 20. And it's just amazing what he's been able to accomplish. And you know, I'm very proud to have been a part of it with him at the very beginning of it.
So, Coach, obviously you talked about being a part of it from the very beginning. I don't know if you know this, but you and Johnny have always been the standard for the backcourt at Duke. And I don't think anybody has ever been able to live up to the expectations that you guys set. So I don't know if you fully know that. But the question I want to ask you is, when you decided to come to Duke, what was it? Like, what made you come to Duke? Obviously, Coach was still building it here, and you know, they were still trying to figure it out. What stood out to you about the recruiting process or about Coach that made you believe in him and want to come here?
Well, John, you've recruited obviously by him and played for him and was one of the better ones to ever play there. And you can attest to, you know, how he is in the recruiting process and in the very beginning of it. And certainly for us, you know, thinking, as you mentioned, you know, Johnny Dawkins and, you know, Mark Allery and Jay Billis and David Henderson and those guys before me were a year before me. But I fell in love with Coach. I believed in him, and I say this now. I believed in him then. I swear by him now. You know, and one of the things that always attracted me to him was how much he believed in me. And that's obviously is a very, very strong thought to have in anyone, and that was there. And I got to, he had a chance to watch us, myself and Johnny, play for the first time on the same night in the Washington, D.C. Jell-O Summer League, and we played in back-to-back games. And he knew then, and which was amazing, that he thought that he had just, you know, had been able to see his future backcourt. And that's the process that started with both of us and Johnny going there the year before me and being, you know, Washington, D.C. native, you know, guy. And then I was coming up after him. And it just, you know, you thought that it was a great place, a great school, great conference. But he was the ultimate difference maker in the fact that, you know, I wanted to play for him. I remember telling him that the night before I came down on my official visit. He called me on a Thursday night to let me know and talk about it. And then I was going to go down on Friday the next day. And I told him that night, I said, Coach, I know I want to play for you. I just, if I'm comfortable there, then that's what I'm going to do. And so I basically told him then the night before the visit. But I knew before, John, as you probably did at some point too, that he was the guy that you wanted to play for and the guy that you believed in. And that's the way it was, you know, almost 100 years ago now when it happened for me.
Right. No question. Well, you know, rumor has it that you were, when you were here as a player, the other guys were a little jealous because not that you could do no wrong, but obviously he loved you big time as a player. So I don't know if you want to, for the record, if you got it as bad as the other guys did when you turned the ball over, even though you didn't do that much. But I don't know if you want to set the record straight on that.
Yeah, they were jealous, and that, you know, I handled my job, and folks appreciated
exactly
it with all that other stuff, you know.
Exactly.
No, I always thought, you know, with all the guys felt like he would never get on myself or Johnny. I always remember my high school coach. I played for a great high school coach, Coach Red Jenkins, and he always would talk about, you know, you never want to yell or rattle the guy with the ball. And I always thought Coach K, you know, was like that as well. So whether you're the quarterback or the point guard, you know, you always have to have a calm, cool relationship and way of dealing with that player. And I've tried to adopt that myself as a coach, realizing that that's the guy that makes the most of the decisions. He handles the ball the most, and he wants to keep it all in order and make it all go. And so I don't know if it was, you know, anything with me. It might just have been my position that I played of how he coached and treated his point guard.
Right. Mike, you were obviously here more recently, being a senior manager, part of that 2015 championship team. But I'm curious, as we're kind of reliving some of the early days of this, when you were growing up, what was the moment you were like, I want to be a part of that. I want to be a part of that program, and I want to go to Duke?
Well, I always loved the school and admired, you know, the school from an academic standpoint and wanted to go to a high academic school. And then I do remember watching the 2001 national championship game and just loving the style of play and everything that Coach stands for in terms of how he runs the program, the way they play, and the kinds of guys that they had. And so for me and my family, we were, you know, Duke fans growing up, but that was definitely a signature moment in terms of, you know, me being attracted to the school and the program and wanting to become a coach.
And obviously the 2010 title team was really what solidified it for you. At least that's what Shire thinks.
I remember sitting there with my dad. Well, sitting would be wrong. We were standing there. And when that shot rimmed out, there was, I think we celebrated as hard as you guys did.
Sats, how has the transition been for you? Obviously, you've done this now for – talk about starting young like your head coach did. But how's the transition been for you? You know, you're on staff. You're a manager here. You're on staff here for a year, and then, bam, you went right into being a coach. How's that transition been for you?
Well, it's been awesome. And the biggest thing is I've been around really good people and really good places. And obviously that starts with Coach K and you, John, being on staff there, and Capel and Woja. I mean, all the guys that were in that program that were really supportive of me and my vision and dream. So none of this happens, obviously, without, you know, you guys. And then being able to come here to Harvard and to work for Coach Amaker has really been an unbelievable honor and something that I'm really proud of, to be able to represent, you know, in a small way, his program and this university. I mean, this is a special place, just like Duke is a special place. And it's been really an honor for me. It's been exciting. And I feel like I've grown tremendously over the 4 or 5 years that I've had the opportunity to kind of be in the profession.
Coach, I feel like it's easy to see things in retrospect, and everyone now looks back to that class. We were talking about that earlier, and you know, whether you want to call it the class that saved Coach K or the class that really kickstarted things here at Duke. But if you look at kind of your coaching career and your steps along the way, whether it's, you know, different challenges or building a program from scratch, I mean, you look at what you've done at Harvard, things that haven't been done literally since the 50s. Looking back now, do you feel like kind of the things you saw Coach K do and the things that you guys did as a team laid the groundwork for what you've now had to do as a coach and building or restarting programs in certain respects?
Without a doubt, you know, so much that I lean on and try to adopt and remember were the moments and the times that when I came through, when we started off with Coach. And as I mentioned earlier about, you know, I always felt that it was brought about at Duke with defense and Duke, meaning that, you know, we're going to establish a style of play and we're also going to embrace the university. So I'm thinking back to moments like that, moments of how he was able to put it together and how he recruited certain ways and certain guys and how he was, you know, adamant in having a standard that he wasn't going to negotiate or compromise, you know. And that's hard to do, you know, as you're trying to build. And especially for me, I've tried to do this now at multiple institutions, and that's not easy. But seeing what he has been able to do through the years and then doing it with, you know, high character guys, you know, other than me, of course, they, you know, high character guys. But, you know, you appreciate those things as you get older and you're lucky enough to stay in this business, in this profession for a while. You appreciate exactly, you know, how he went about it and the ways that he did it. I mentioned that to him just recently and talked to him about even his family having a tremendous impact in that way with Mrs. K and obviously and his daughters, and how much I asked him about how much they influenced and helped him become a better coach and a better teacher and a better leader. And he talked about that. And so recognizing all the pieces and the layers that come with an opportunity to represent a school, build a program, try to take it to, you know, heights that you've never, you know, been able to scale before, and he's done it better than anyone. He's as they say, the GOAT. You know, there's no question about that. And so, thinking, the only thing I always say is that, you know, we're not able to ever come close to touching him in terms of what he's been able to do is to recruit the darn players that he's been able to get. You included, John. You know, he's been amazing at just continually reeling in and recruiting the top-level people and players, and it's just been astonishing how he's been able to continue to do that and build the brand of Duke basketball.
No, like you said, it's the ability to adapt over time. Is for me, it's been fun to see. Just when you talk about recruiting you and Johnny all the way to, you know, the classes we're trying to put together now, is incredible. Coach, I have a question about when you were a player, obviously as you guys were getting started, at what point did you know your team could do something special?
You know, it's interesting you say that because we recruit kids now, and some of the things that I've had to answer or to address with certain kids when you start or building a program, one of the questions are, you know, are we going to win, or are you sure we can, you know, so the skepticism at times can be, I don't know what it was. Like, I talked to John, he talked to other guys when we first went there. I don't think we ever, I know I didn't, I'll just speak for myself here. I never questioned whether, is this going to work? I don't know if that was being naive or just the total belief and confidence in our program and coach and even in myself, but it just never dawned on me that this wouldn't work. And I think of that as something that, you know, is incredibly meaningful. And as we have been able to grow and build, you know, our program, I thought back to some moments of when you asked about when did I think it had a chance. I remember my freshman year, you know, with Mr. Butters, the athletic director at the time, the legendary AD, comes in with Coach K and comes in the locker room. And the locker room wasn't like it is now, John. It was a little bit of a wired, you know, metal lockers, and, you know, you had the combination lock on it like it's in some intramural kind of place. And but he came in and just basically closed the door and just said, I want all you guys to know that, you know, I've just signed your coach to a new 5-year, you know, contract. And, you know, because that was on the bubbling of the surface there a little bit. I didn't know about it to a great degree, but you heard rumors of things that, you know, is it going to work? Is, you know, Krzyzewski or whatever. And so that was said to us then. I remember another moment to where as a, you know, as a player where we, you know, we started off really well and we won our first conference road game, and it was at UVA. And that's for me going back to my home state and, you know, recruited by them. And so that was a meaningful moment. And you think, you know, we have a chance to put something, we were all very young, and it wasn't like it is today where you're thinking of guys could, you know, obviously they could leave, but it just wasn't the way that the world worked then. And so you felt like even we were on the path of doing something. One of the biggest things you can do as a coach trying to build a program is to establish an identity, is to be able to establish a style of play and be able to sell that, not only to your players, your current players, but to recruits and even to your fans and supporters, that they believe in how you're going about playing, and is it exciting and interesting for people to watch and for kids to want to be a part of. Well, we were able to do that my first year there. I thought I was a big piece to helping that to be created of how we wanted to play defensively and pressure the ball and man-to-man. And I thought that was a big piece of knowing that we had something pretty good because we adapted to that. We embraced that very well. And I thought that meant a lot to Coach because that's what how he really wanted to go about building his program was through defense. And so I knew then that we had something that could grow to build, who no one, I think, was thinking at the time it could come to be what it's, you know, evolved into now. But we knew that we were going to be a good team. We recognized people were, you know, taking us seriously. I mean, we were young and I think the other thing that we were pretty hungry to prove ourselves. And obviously that comes right through him. And so I don't know a specific moment. I'm just sharing some times with you when you felt right, like things were being thought of in the right place and some of the reasons why.
No question. You know, Coach, for you, how about, so you talk about the belief you had throughout, which I think is obviously huge, and Coach believed in you guys. How about a favorite moment as a player? Where is there a game that stands out to you, or even a practice, or a moment that a couple of them that stand out?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things, and I say this a lot with, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have chances to speak to different organizations on and off campus here in our community and elsewhere, especially in the business world here at Harvard Business School. And one of the things I always remember, you know, Coach taught palms up. You know, that was kind of the legendary way that you taught defense of being defending on the ball with your palms up, so you weren't susceptible to, you know, slapping or reaching. So you would slap up or reach up, which wasn't a way that you could probably get called for a foul. And that was kind of, you know, the way of teaching defense, and everybody knew that. And I, whatever reason, I didn't play that way. I had my arms up and out, and my hands were kind of open. And, you know, he kind of, you know, stopped. And I wouldn't say he yelled, but I would say maybe he barked, John, and that there's a difference in those two things with him, as you know. So he barked at me and stopped practice and told me, said that, you know, told me DuPont, you know, why aren't you doing it? And I didn't know, as you probably know too, John, I didn't know if I was really supposed to answer him or if he was just saying that, you know,
exactly.
Why aren't you doing that? And I didn't know if he wanted me to answer or not, you know, and I'm a freshman. And I finally just said, you know, he asked me again, he said, why, you know, and I said, well, I'm more comfortable that way. And then he just kind of paused, and it was a kind of a silence. It seemed like forever, but it was just really very brief. And then he said, okay, let's go. And so I always remember that as being something that I thought of. I love that. And he listened to me as a player. Like he trusted me that I right. thought I could do it this way or I was more comfortable doing it this way. And it meant a lot to me. And I always think of that, like when I ask our players or how do they feel about something, or they have to do it and they have to be able to do it in a way that they're comfortable and confident doing it. And so I remember that. And that was always something that taught me a lot about him and taught me a lot about also teaching and leading, being able to have that kind of collaboration, if you will, with your players and the trust that he had in me to do it. So, and then it made me feel like I better do it right, I better do it well, because he allowed me to do it my way. And so that was a big moment, you know, for me. I remember, you know, as a player, we played in my junior year, which was the 86 team. That was their senior year. We played in the final game of the regular season against North Carolina at Cameron, and it was kind of over spring break. No one left. It was our first moment to have a chance to, you know, win our league, win the regular season. Everything was on the line. As you played in those games, John, you know what I mean. It's all kind of boiling down to those moments. And this was interesting because the regular season title was on the line between us and them. The number one seed was on the line between us and them for the ACC tournament. And then the number one ranking in the country was on the line, and probably number one seed in the NCAA tournament. All that was kind of there. And I remember I'm setting all that up because it's you can think of that kind of game and the intensity and whatever. And then we have our normal pregame talk, a few things he would say. And then he would always – we go out and come back in, and then he would have something else to say and, you know, really inspire us to go out on the floor to play. And when he came back the second time, he just looked around and kind of looked at everyone in the locker room, and he just said, let's go. And it was nothing else needed to be said. And I think about that because it was such a powerful moment for us as a team, because it was another moment where he had the ultimate belief and trust in us. There was nothing else to go over. There was nothing else to remind us, or there was nothing else to kind of inspire us or to motivate us. It was he read the room, and I don't know if it was planned or not, but that's how he did it. And I remember that till this day. Everyone asked me, what's the greatest pregame talk that you ever heard? And I always talk about that one when there was no words to be said. which was the most meaningful one to me as a player, because, again, it was the trust and the belief that I know you guys are ready. I know you're going to go out and do what you need to do and play the best you can. And it was powerful, as powerful as it can be for me. And so those were some of the moments as individual and then one as a team for us that I vividly remember, you know, during that time, during that, you know, sensational year we had and going on to the Final Four and, you know, obviously playing and having a gut-wrenching loss that year to Louisville.
What do you remember about that national championship game, Coach?
What I remember about it?
Yeah, what do you remember about it? You know, you guys were the first to get there. And
I remember.
Not trying to bring up bad memories here.
Yeah, still haunted, John. But I remember that, you know, it was one of those where you feel in certain ways for a game like that or a season. We had, I don't know, 21 or 22 game winning streak. I mean, we had won 37 games. I mean, we were, I don't know. I mean, it's almost like you feel like it's supposed to happen. And then it's almost right. So unreal that it didn't happen when it was over. And obviously they played against a great team and, you know, arguably deserving to win or not. I mean, team could have won the game, a 3-point victory. But just one of those where you just really feel the pain of something that you honestly felt like you was supposed to happen, deserved to happen, and it didn't happen. And that's another life lesson. You know, even though you feel you've done all that you're supposed to do and you deserve this opportunity or this victory, whatever, that doesn't mean it's just always going to happen and go your way. And so you're grateful for when it does happen and you are victorious, so you have those special moments to win, because you recognize how fragile it is and how easily things can go in one direction or the other. And so I always remember Johnny Dawkins when I was on the staff, and then we won the first national championship for coaching, and I was a staff member in 1991, and talking to Johnny on the phone, and I was on staff, and he was still playing in the NBA, and talking to him, and he asked me, did that help, you know, make up for the one that we lost, you know, the one we lost in 86? And I always remember telling him, and we talked about it, there's nothing that can replace the one as a player. You know, it's certainly, you know, you felt great about it on the staff as an assistant, but it will never erase that one that we weren't able to get in 86. But it was one of those things that it helped, but it never took the place of it.
Right.
Mike, I feel like one of the things that isn't talked about Coach so much, everyone thinks of him as this brilliant X's and O's guys, but how he can take every person that's around the program and make them feel like their role is integral to what the team is doing, what the program is doing day in and day out. And he is always, at least in my time here, had a very unique connection, a special connection with everybody, and whether it be the managers or who on down. I'm curious if you've got a story or two from your perspective and your time here where you had a moment with him where he had one of those, or a moment where what that relationship like was between you guys.
Sure. Well, he was terrific with us and treated us equal to any other member of the organization. What that kind of created as a manager group was ownership of the program and the culture. And so we really felt like we were part of it, and that, you know, just like players don't want to let their teammates down, we didn't want to let, you know, the players down, the coaches down, and certainly our other managers down. And so it sets a very high standard of performance that we tried to live up to every day. But that starts, like you said, with the relationship that coach builds with each manager. It's not like you just kind of roll in and rebound for guys. Like, no, you're fully a part of it. And that's a special thing. And it's something that obviously makes it even more meaningful when you're there.
Coach, we'll let you go on this. You know, we talked a lot about your time here as a player, and rightfully so, but as you transition to coaching, you're obviously on staff here for quite a bit before you went over and took over the program at Seton Hall, and obviously on to Michigan and now at Harvard. But when you look back, I'm curious the dynamic and the conversations you have with Coach. How have they evolved from when you were a player to being on a staff and now to having a program of your own? Is it a similar tone and style you guys go with, or has it changed over the years?
You know, it has evolved and has grown, actually. As a player, you're never really aware, at least I wasn't, and John, you can speak to it as well, of how much goes into it on the other side when you're a staff member. And so as a player, you know, you recognize that, you know, everyone works hard and putting in time for us to be better, and, you know, as coaches and as a, you know, staff members, and all of that happens. But as a player, maybe you're just not as completely aware, at least I wasn't, of how much, you know, that the staff really does and how the commitment that's there and the intensity about everything and how much I love the part of being a staff member, that it was all-encompassing with, you know, the recruiting, with the leading, the teaching, the basketball aspects of it, but, you know, the well-being of your players, the student-athletes that you have, you know, trying to market a brand or coming up with creative ideas. I mean, maybe, you know, back then we had to do that at Duke. I don't know that that's probably the case, you know, now, or hasn't been for quite some time. But at that time, you know, whether it's your camps and your clinics and all the things that you're growing, you're building. And I love that whole aspect of you're running an organization. You're running a business. And Coach was a CEO. He is a CEO. He runs it in that fashion. And so for me to be a witness to that aspect of it and learn that aspect of it, I felt it was fascinating, and I love that. And so when I have opportunities to learn from him now as a head coach, I have even more appreciation, you know, for all the things that he was able to accomplish and to do. And that means, you know, having a staff, you know, managing a staff, hiring a staff, teaching your staff, all the things that come, you know, with having an organization that you're responsible for. And so the conversations we have now are on levels like that. You know, when I would ask him, did he go through this? That was one of the things I asked him just recently. I had two of my former players here at Harvard. We're getting married on the same day. And I said, Coach, you know, that's one of the questions I had to ask. I said, I don't know what to do. I said, what? Did you ever had that before? And he said, no, I haven't. So That may be the first thing that he said to me, and no, I haven't heard that one before. But just all kinds of things that come up that are basketball related, but more program, you know, institution. I mean, one of the great things that he, you know, he's always done and has taught us to do as we go on and try to start our own professional, you know, careers as head coaches at various places to make sure that we are, you know, building relationships throughout the university community, you know, not just in the athletic department. You know, he's done those kinds of things. So I don't know that many coaches or head coaches, you know, do those things or talk about those kinds of things or teach your staff members the value of those things. But, you know, all that's been a part of the growth and development and the conversations and the moments that I have with him now are on that level or in depth of things like that, you know, that require you thinking of yourself as a teacher and as a leader on your respective campus. And that, boy, there's a lot that comes with that.
Well, Coach and Mike, thank you guys very much for coming on. It's always great to have some Duke family on here. And, you know, the reality is, Coach, and I know you're going to brush it off and not make it a thing, but I would not be here if it was not for you and that team that got us started. And so thank you. And Mike, you've been one of the great managers and great people to come through here. And so thank you for all that you do. And obviously we wish you guys best of luck this upcoming season.
Well, guys, thanks so much for having us. And you know, Mike is Coach Sod has been, you know, been an amazing addition, you know, for us here on our staff, you know, as a valued coach and assistant coach in our program. And you guys are continue to carry the banner and what you're doing for the program and certainly for and with Coach. Great to be on, and thank you for the kind words. And, you know, we're proud to all be a part of it, as you know, John, and to make this the only thing I ask in return for us being on is that, you know, at some point, John, you better help us get a player that and someone that you
real.
Guys actually want. I don't want somebody that you guys don't. We want someone that you want, and that's
fair.
Our goal.
That's fair.
We can ever get someone that Duke wants to come play for us at Harvard.
You got it. That's fair.
Appreciate it, guys.
You got it.
Really enjoyed having Tommy on. That was a great conversation, he and Mike Sotsky as well. Kind of crazy to look back and see how far it's come and how Coach maybe is a little bit different, but maybe not all that different from where he was when this thing got going. All right, before we get out of here, let's get our three-point shot up. We know you don't get a weekend off very often, so don't want to take up too much of your time, but no off weekends, right?
No.
Doesn't exist. So the last couple of games Duke has had, if you guys were watching the television broadcast, you heard both Jay Billis and then Dick Vitale look at the jump shot for Matthew Hurd, and both of them compared it a little bit to Larry Bird, which kind of came to my mind as you guys are coaching and mentoring guys and thinking of ways to help them improve. Everyone's body type is different. Everyone's shot is different. How much do you try to tweak what they do or mold what you're teaching to what they already have, so to speak?
No, it's a good question. I think it depends, you know, player to player. I think for Matt, in his particular case, you know, he already had a great jump shot. You know, I think the thing with him, sometimes he leans back with it, you know, and gets a little flat. And, you know, when he shoots it where shoulders are over his toes and he holds his follow through, he shoots the ball at a really high percentage. And he's been shooting as well as anybody in the country, especially as of late. And so that's been a lot of fun to see. He's been putting in a ton of work. And he's been shooting it the same way. He's been very consistent at it. So I think it depends from guy to guy. With Matt, he just needs to keep doing what he's doing right now.
And with his size and that release point, whether it's a three-point shot or mid-range game, almost impossible to defend. He can get it up anytime he wants to.
Yeah, it is. He gets it off quickly, and he's got a high release. And, you know, it's funny that Jay mentioned that. You know, Coach K has said that several times, that his shot reminds him of Larry Bird's because of the way he shoots it. So, anyway, we got to keep going.
All right, let's move on to the second topic. Jeff Capel's making his return, obviously, on Tuesday night, so it brings to mind. Coach has done this several times now, of course, most recently in the NCAA tournament, facing off against Johnny Dawkins, someone that he coached at one point, now coaching against. This happens from time to time when guys have been on the same team and then face off. For you, do you have a story or memory of someone you were on a team with at one point that then you had to turn around and face off against?
Well, not exactly teammates and then played against, but it's the opposite. You know, Gerald Henderson, I remember playing against him and playing against Brian Zubek in AU in the summertime, and then we came here and were teammates. And, you know, I have the bragging rights over both of them. I beat
Zubes' team by 30, and I beat Gerald's team. It was a closer game, but Gerald and I were being recruited, similar positions, obviously different games, but we remember the Duke staff telling both of us, you know, this is the other guy we're recruiting. At that point, you didn't have the social media, and you didn't know one another as well. So I think both of us were filling each other out. I do remember he didn't want to guard me that game. He did not guard me. My team won. And then when we got to Duke, I made sure he heard it basically every day we were here for 3 years.
Now that's a distinction. He didn't guard you, or he didn't want to guard you? Imagine, would he say it the same way you did?
He would say it the same exact way. He would say that. Yeah, he did not want to guard me. We'll get him on.
We got to verify that. All right, let's get to our third topic. Zion Williamson, much like he did for college basketball, took the NBA by storm, literally. One game in with a 17-point stretch in the fourth quarter. Just give everyone a flavor of what he's going to be able to do when he gets fully healthy. 8 of 11 from the field, 4 of 4 from 3, 7 rebounds, 3 assists, 22 points. We're not shocked because we saw it up close and personal last year, but it did bring to my mind, I'm going to put you on the spot, a lot of Blue Devils down there in New Orleans. They lost the game, unfortunately, to San Antonio. 121 to 117 was the final score, which leaves them 4 games behind the Spurs for the final playoff spot in the West with like 35 games to go or something like that. We're going to see the Pelicans in the playoffs this year.
I think they sneak in there. They've been, even before Zion got back, they were heading in the right direction. They got off to a horrible start. But especially with Zion back, it adds a different dimension. I think they're going to have enough to sneak in there and get in the playoffs.
It's amazing what he can do. I mean, I was watching that game on Wednesday night. Building had no life, and then all of a sudden, he did something that you don't see very often. Took a regular season NBA game and turned it into what reminded me of a college atmosphere.
Right. It doesn't happen very often.
No, not at all. Well, the Blue Devils are back to work on Tuesday night, taking on the Panthers of Pittsburgh, and we'll talk to you guys next week. Coach, appreciate it.
Thanks again.
See you guys.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.